beautiful piece to celebrate the rain, although I have to say I've been joking this week because of all the rain that we've had and all the rain we're going to have, that if April showers bring May flowers, then come next week we'll have lots of carnivorous plants growing all over the place. The first reading this morning comes from Marianne Sawicki, a professor of philosophy at Penn State and a rather brilliant scholar on early Christian origins. This is from her book, Seeing the Lord, 1994.
Resurrection, in first century Jewish thought, was expected as part of the new age that was going to begin. Opinions varied as to the scope or whether it would happen at all, but the notion intended a mass resurrection, a resurrection to a restored life here on earth, and not the singular privilege of someone who would appear alone here after his own death and then disappear altogether. Thus, the culturally available image of the rising of the dead was not a good fit for the case of Jesus. He was forced into that mold, a mold with considerable warping. What then was happening with Jesus before the women brought forth their story that he rose up and left his tomb empty? His body was being recognized in the bodies of other genders, classes, and ethnicities than his own, leaking through the cracks, getting around the borders. Jesus didn't need an empty tomb until he became the fulfiller of prophecies.
The second reading is from the ecstatic poet, the Rumi of America, I like to call him sometimes, James Broughton, from his collection, Lauds. This poem is exactly 30 years old. And it's called The Gardener of Eden.
I am the old dreamer that never sleeps. I am the timekeeper of the timeless dance. I preserve the long rhythms of the earth and fertilize the rounds of desire. In my evergreen arboretum, I raise flowering hopes for the world. I plant seeds of perennial affection and wait for their passionate bloom. Would you welcome that sight if you saw it, revalue the view you have lost? Could you wake to the innocent morning and follow the risks of your heart? Every day I grow a dream in my garden, where the beds are laid out for love. When will you come to embrace it and join in the joy of the dance?
So today is Easter. Our English word for this day, Easter, is somewhat odd among the languages of the earth. It distinguishes us from most every other language. In Greek, in Bulgarian, today is called Pascha. In Russian, Pascha. In French, Pâques. In Italian, Pasqua. In Indonesian, Pasca. In Norwegian, Pasca. In Spanish, Pascua. All of which come, some of you will have by now guessed, from the Hebrew word for the Jewish freedom holiday, Passover, Pesach. But in English, it's Easter, which sounds an awful lot like the direction east, which makes sense. Because a man that we now call the Venerable Bede, who lived in the 700s, back at the very beginning of our language, asserts that the word Easter derived from Aostra Monat, which would translate as the month of April, named, he thought, for a long-lost goddess of the dawn, the East. We have apparently never found any supportive evidence for what he says, any place else, so we have a lot of conjecture at this point. In a few other languages, like Czech and Polish, Easter is called by words that translate the great day or the great night in one case. And in Serbian and in Japanese, today is simply referred to in the sounds of their languages as Resurrection Day. Now, resurrection is a word that predates Easter by a long shot. Egyptians, Greeks, and some Asians, and even some liberal Jews called the Pharisees back in the first century, all spoke of it. More conservative Jews in the days of Jesus thought it was rather a nutty idea. For some, it was a symbolic or even a political expression, but for others, it was some kind of a literal hope, as real, well, as rain. But as Marianne Sawicki points out, for the Jews who did believe in the concept, it was never, ever used in the singular. Never. It always referred to a whole group of people rising up at the same time, whatever they meant by that. There was no privilege given to any particular person. It was never going to be just one great big round stone rolling away from the mouth of a tomb, but all of them, and at the same time. And so, Sawicki says, the creators of the resurrection stories in the Gospels were forced to distort the original idea a great deal. He was forced into that mold, she writes very strongly, a mold with considerable warping. Strong language. Then Sawicki asks the following amazing question and then answers it for herself. What then was happening with Jesus before the women brought forth, that is, created, the story that he rose up and left his tomb empty? His body, she says, was being recognized in the bodies of other genders, classes, and ethnicities than his own, leaking through the cracks, getting around the borders. We're entering into poetic language now. The empty tomb story is a later addition to the story of Jesus. Jesus' body was probably thrown into a common pit like everyone else who was executed by the Romans in those days. Necessary mourning rituals were thus denied to the family and friends of the deceased, a cruel finale to a truly awful death. This loss of a mourning site was especially terrible in the ancient Near East, with its proud tradition of women taking care of the bodies of and ritually mourning the dead. Men had little to do with such things. Their grief was often contained and suppressed by strict cultural norms and conventions. Women, however, were the ones who touched the bodies, who washed them, and anointed them with scented oils for burial, and who did the public mourning. They were often trained from birth to weep in public ceremonially, almost like a choir of tears. And it's from this tradition of women mourning at tombs that the first Easter stories stem. Traces of these ideas are found in the gospel stories of women coming to the tomb of Jesus to wash and anoint his body on Easter morning. More traces of these ideas are found in the gospel stories that have come down to us. People only recognizing this risen Jesus in the bodies of other people who are still alive, like the dusty traveler in one story walking down the road, like in another story, a cook making breakfast on the beach, or in a third story, a stranger who arrives at their door and eats a bit of honeycomb with them. The most famous of these Easter stories in the Gospels is the one where Mary of Magdala interprets a poor slave, that is, a gardener, as the risen Jesus. The gardener, in fact, is taking care of the very garden where Jesus' tomb was, according to John. Gardens. Not something I know very much about. I live in a loft downtown. I do grow a few kitchen herbs in pots along my windowsill, rosemary, mint, tarragon. But I am not Mr. Green Jeans by any stretch of the imagination. But as someone who reads a lot for his work, and I do recognize the literary meaning of placing the tomb of Jesus in a garden. The image of the garden is found at the very beginning of the Hebrew Scriptures, a very significant image, the well-known Garden of Eden. When the Gospel of John places the tomb in a garden, it's not geography, but a reference to the original mythic garden, the mythic garden where the tree of life used to grow. The tree of life, the fruit of which would keep people from ever dying, keep all the flowers from wilting, keep everything the same forever. The Garden of Eden, in short, was a magic garden, a garden where the plants and flowers never droop or die. Pretty much like the story we heard about this morning in the children's story. A garden where the rabbits don't do what comes naturally and eat the greens. A garden where the produce is gigantic. A garden where everything glows in the dark. Where all of our wishes and whims come true. Like that. Where nothing changes for the worse, ever. And nothing is lost, ever. A fantasy place. And a place, I'm sorry to say, where I often live sometimes myself, thinking in my heart that death is not something that's ever going to happen to me. Oh, intellectually, I know it, but in my heart, I walk away from it. I am aware that I often think of death as a surprise, a trick. It's never expected, even when I am expecting it. Thinking of it is always a subject to be avoided. But in the Easter interpretation of the Garden of Eden, and that's exactly what these stories are, there is not a tree of life at the center of the garden, is there? There is a tomb at the center of the garden. The passage declares that death is part of the garden cycle. It's natural. No flower blooms forever. They all wilt eventually. Death is part of life. Amen. The older magic garden with its tree of life does not exist anymore. And the Easter story suggests we were probably right to leave such a garden. That is, to leave the notion that things last forever and that we can have the world as we like it by magic. The Easter story, however, adds a new metaphor and says that the tomb is empty. In other words, although death is part of reality, it is not as powerful as life itself. Life, as the flowers reveal to us every spring, always blooms again. These are not the flowers we had last year. These are new flowers. They look pretty much the same. They're just as glorious, just as colorful, just as sweetly scented. Life all over is like that, the Easter story tells us. life rises again and new people being born year after year. The children of our church will grow and become adults over time. They are alive. They change. They grow. The dead, however, never change. They have stopped growing. Death is changelessness. But life is growth, and life is risk, and life is freedom. The garden of life blooms anew over and over again in the spring. The poet James Broughton asks us this in his poem, Gardener of Eden. Would you welcome that sight if you saw it? Revalue the view that you have lost? Could you wake to the innocent morning and follow the risks of your heart? He speaks of what it means to plant a garden. I raise flowering hopes for the world. I plant seeds of perennial affection and wait for their passionate bloom. In other words, the flowers, though they don't last forever, will come up again next year. They will look pretty much the same, but they will be growing in the mulch of flowers that grew before them and are rotting into rich soil. Those new flowers aren't the same flowers as the former ones, but they are just as beautiful, just as diverse, just as stunning, and just as fragile. And this helps me to think about Easter these days, this day which is about life and death. It's about, in fact, not just life and death, the life and death of an ancient teacher. It's not just about his relationships with Mary of Magdala and strangers. It's about my life. It's about my death, too. Here's how I've been seeing it. Here is the comfort. Here is the flowering hope, to use Broughton's words, that gets me through the day. I say that right now you don't see all of me. You only see the present momentary form of me. Part of me has already died. Part of me is already gone for good. Where is the fellow who was writing the sermon last night? Gone. You don't see him. Where is the boy he used to play in the mud at his grandmother's house and in her rock garden at age 6? Can you see him? You cannot. He's gone. Where is the factory worker in Detroit making leaf springs for Dodge trucks? Or the sculptor fashioning figures out of terracotta in college? Gone. Where is the happy man in a 16-year-long relationship of love? Gone. Where is the shy, skinny teenager walking the halls of the house at 15414 Spring Garden Avenue in Detroit, Michigan? House is still there, I suppose, but who knows who's living there now? I'm not. That me that lived there is dead and buried in the tomb of memory. Furthermore, if through an accident I lost my leg, would I be losing me? If I lost my address, as I have many times, like many of you, I've moved a number of times in my life, or if I lose my hearing, as my doctor assures me I am doing, would I be losing me, the most alive part of me, the most essential part of me? Would I have to stop being me when I lost all that? It seems to me these days that as I think over my life, that the most important, that is, the most alive parts of me are invisible. They cannot be placed on a scale. They are not my addresses, my phone numbers, my body parts, my former brown and long hair, or my blood sugar count. These visible things all change, and eventually all of them will pass away. But my love for my son, Tony, my love for my mother, Elisa, my love for my sister Lynn or my cousin Sergio, my love for my friend Richard or Doug or Kevin or Kim, is the most real part of me. I have planted these seeds of love in the garden of the world, in the garden of my life. I water them daily with attention and care. Even if I have to weed the garden now and then, I've lost friends because we no longer gel. I still see the garden growing, the flowers rising. Not the same as last year, but alive and beautiful and connected by love to the most alive part of me. When it comes time for me to die, I have every intention of dabbling in a bit of resurrection myself. Not of my body, but of the love I leave behind. The best part of me, the seeds I've sown for potential harvest one day. You won't recognize me. I may look like a gardener then, or a cook making breakfast on the beach, or a dusty traveler walking down the road next to you. Who knows? It's not really important that you recognize me by name. After all, that's not very important in the scheme of things either, now, is it? I could change it even today with the stroke of a pen, and then who would I be? No, I'm not even my name, but I am alive. I think the ancients were right when they joked, "You can't take it with you." No, you can't. You have to leave it right here. The echoes of the love, devotion, kindness, healing, forgiveness, and justice work that you leave behind are the most important parts of you. As far as I'm concerned, neither my ego or even my memories and hopes are more important than the quality of the relationships I am woven into over the years. Jesus of Galilee was executed and his body was thrown into a pit on an April day 1,981 years ago. But when Bishop Tutu conducts the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, or Dorothy Day opens a hospitality house, or my Mennonite friends refuse to fight in war, or the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee sends help to Japan or Haiti, or people from this congregation help resurrect a shattered New Orleans, I wonder why anyone thinks that so weak a thing as death can silence the greatness of life. So call today Easter if you favor English, or Pascha, or Pasqua, or just the great day. Don't look now, but you might at least begin to hear the rattle of many, many stones rolling away from the tombs in the garden of this world. I close with the inimitable Broughton. Every day I grow a dream in my garden where the beds are laid out for love. When will you come to embrace it? When will you come to join in the joy of the dance?
Will the flower blessers please come forward? Need one more. Aha, we're all here.
Yeah, come on in.
They need to put down their Easter baskets first.
Okay, I understand.
Yeah. Spirit of life, let these flowers speak to us this morning of our lives here upon the earth. Our lives beneath the sun, beneath the rain, beneath the stars.
May they remind us amid diversities of gifts and diversities of knowledge and feeling to find strength in our differences and unity in our common desire to live just and happy lives.
May they remind us of the value of friendship where we may share the realities of our hidden heart and support each other.
May they make a portrait of a cherished community where distinctions are expressions of beauty, not sources of annexity.
May we never compete with each other, but to cooperate together to build a future of peace, justice, and freedom for all. Let these flowers remind us that it is not important what we look like or whether our efforts are great or small at any given time, but nevertheless, all of us are in this together.
And now, let's say the prayer over the flowers together. It's in your order celebration. And the children may come forward now while we say this. Now kindle the flame wherever sorrow...
Whenever sorrow reigns, tell the stories of those who overcame their troubles. Breathe in the flowers of faithfulness, the air of love. Join your heart to the hearts of all who suffer. Let wounds heal and eyes shine again with joy.
You will now receive the flowers. Those words, by the way, were written by Norbert Chopek back in 1923. He was the inventor, the creator of this ceremony of the flowers back in the days when the Czech Republic was burgeoning. He was put to death as a Unitarian minister who resisted the Nazis in 1943.